trifle strained, what with Monsieur le Comte and his captain both glaring at me, Jamie glowering menacingly at them, and the dead man staring sightlessly up at the ceiling 40 feet above. The Comte took a step toward me, eyes glittering. "Have you any notion what you have done?" he snarled. "Be warned, madame. You will pay for this day's work." Jamie moved suddenly in the Comte's direction, but Jared was even faster, tugging at Jamie's sleeve, pushing me gently in the direction of the door, and murmuring something unintelligible to the stricken captain, who merely shook his head dumbly in response. "Poor bugger," Jared said outside, shaking his head. "Phew!" It was chilly on the quay, with a cold grey wind that rocked the ships at anchor. But Jared mopped his face and neck with a large incongruous red sailcloth handkerchief pulled from the pocket of his coat. "Come on, laddie, let's find a tavern. I'm needing a drink." Safely ensconced in the upper room of one of the quayside taverns, with a pitcher of wine on the table, Jared collapsed into a chair, fanning himself, and exhaled noisily. "God, what luck!" He poured a large dollop of wine into his cup, tossed it off, and poured another. Seeing me staring at him, he grinned and pushed the pitcher in my direction. "Well, there's wine, lassie," he explained, "and then there's the stuff you drink to wash the dust away. Toss it back quick before you have time to taste it, and it does the job handily." Taking his own advice, he drained the cup and reached for the pitcher again. I began to see exactly what had happened to Jamie the day before. "Good luck or bad?" I asked Jared curiously. I would have assumed the answer to be bad, but the little merchant's air of jovial exhilaration seemed much too pronounced to be due to the red wine, which strongly resembled battery acid. I set down my own cup, hoping the enamel on my molars was intact. "Bad for Saint-Germain, good for me," he said succinctly. He rose from his chair and peered out the window. "Good," he said, sitting down again with a satisfied air. "I'll have the wine off and into the warehouse by sunset, safe and sound." Jamie leaned back in his chair, surveying his cousin with one eyebrow raised, a smile on his lips. "Do we take it that Monsieur le Comte Saint-Germain's ship also carried spirits, cousin?" An ear-to-ear grin in reply displayed two gold teeth in the lower jaw, which made Jared look still more piratical. "The best aged port from Pinhão," he said happily. "Cost him a fortune. Half the vintage from the Noval vineyards, and no more available for a year." "And I suppose the other half of the Noval port is what's being unloaded into your warehouse." I began to understand his delight. "Right, my lassie, right as rain." Jared chortled, almost hugging himself at the thought. "Do you know what that will sell for in Paris?" he demanded, rocking forward and banging his cup down on the table. "A limited supply, and me with a monopoly. God, my profit's made for the year." I rose and looked out the window myself. The Ariana rode at anchor, already noticeably higher in the water as the huge cargo nets swung down from the boom mounted on the rear deck to be carefully unloaded, bottle by bottle, into handcarts for the trip to the warehouse. "Not to impair the general rejoicing," I said, a little diffidently, "but did you say that your port came from the same place as Saint-Germain's shipment?"
"Aye, I did."
Jared came to stand next to me, squinting down at the procession of loaders below.
"Noval makes the best port in the whole of Spain and Portugal. I'd have liked to take the whole bottling, but hadn't the capital." "What of it?"
"Only that if the ships are coming from the same port, there's a chance that some of your seamen might have smallpox too," I said.
The thought blanched the wine flush from Jared's lean cheeks, and he reached for a restorative gulp. "God, what a thought," he said, gasping as he set the cup down. "But I think it's all right," he said, reassuring himself. "The port's half unloaded already, but I'd best speak to the captain anyway. he added, frowning. "I'll have him pay the men off as soon as the loading's finished. And if anyone looks ill, they can have their wages and leave at once."
He turned decisively and shot out of the room, pausing at the door just long enough to call over his shoulder, "Order some supper," before disappearing down the stair with a clatter like a small herd of elephants. I turned to Jamie, who was staring bemusedly into his undrunk cup of wine.
"He shouldn't do that," I exclaimed. "If he has got smallpox on board, he could spread it all over the city by sending men off with it."
Jamie nodded slowly.
"Then I'll suppose we'll hope he hasn't got it," he observed mildly.
I turned uncertainly toward the door.
"But shouldn't we do something? I could at least go have a look at his men."
"And tell them what to do with the bodies of the men from the other ship."
"Sassenach."
The deep voice was still mild, but it held an unmistakable note of warning.
"What?"
I turned back to find him leaning forward, regarding me levelly over the rim of his cup. He looked at me thoughtfully for a minute before speaking.
"Do you think what we've set ourselves to do is important, Sassenach?"
My hand dropped from the door handle.
"Stopping the Stuarts from starting a rising in Scotland? Yes, of course I do. Why do you ask?"
He nodded, patient as an instructor with a slow pupil.
"Aye, well, if you do, then you'll come back here, sit yourself down, drink wine with me until Jared comes back. And if you don't..."
He paused and blew out a long breath that stirred the ruddy wave of hair above his forehead.
"If you don't, then you'll go down to a quay full of seamen and merchants who think women near ships are the height of ill luck, who are already spreading gossip that you've put a curse on Saint-Germain's ship, and you'll tell them what they must do. With luck, they'll be too afraid of you to rape you before they cut your throat and toss you in the harbour, and me after you. If Saint-Germain himself doesn't strangle you first. Did you no see the look on his face?"
I came back to the table and sat down, a little abruptly. My knees were a trifle wobbly.
"I saw it," I said. "But could he?" "He wouldn't."
Jamie raised his brows and pushed a cup of wine across the table to me.
"He could, and he would, if he thought it could be managed inconspicuously. For the Lord's sake, Sassenach, you've cost the man close on a year's income, and he doesn't look the sort to take such a loss philosophically. Had you not told the harbour master it was smallpox out loud in front of witnesses, a few discreet bribes would have taken care of the matter. As it is, why do you think Jared brought us up here so fast? For the quality of the drink?"
My lips felt stiff, as though I'd actually drunk a good bit of the vitriol from the pitcher.
"You mean we're in danger?"
He sat back, nodding.
"Now you've got it,"
he said kindly.
"I don't suppose Jared wanted to alarm you. I expect he's gone to arrange a guard of some kind for us, as well as to see to his crew. He'll likely be safe enough. Everyone knows him. And his crew and loaders are right outside."
I rubbed my hands over the goose flesh that rippled up my forearms. There was a cheerful fire in the hearth, and the room was warm and smoky. But I felt cold.
"How do you know so much about what the Comte Saint-Germain might do?"
I didn't doubt Jamie at all. I remembered all too well the malevolent black glare the Comte had shot at me in the warehouse. But I did wonder how he knew the man. Jamie took a small sip of the wine, made a face, and put it down.
"For the one thing, he's some reputation for ruthlessness. And other things. I heard a bit about him when I lived in Paris before, though I had the luck never to run afoul of the man then. For another, Jared spent some time yesterday warning me about him. He's Jared's chief business rival in Paris."
I rested my elbows on the battered table and parked my chin on my folded hands. I've made rather a mess of things, haven't I? I said ruefully.
Got you off on a fine footing in business.
He smiled, then got up and came behind me, bending to put his arms around me. I was still rather unnerved from his sudden revelations, but felt much better to feel the strength and the bulk of him behind me. He kissed me lightly on top of the head.
"Dinna worry, Sassnach," he said. "I can take care of myself."
"And I can take care of you too. And you'll let me."
There was a smile in his voice, but a question as well. And I nodded, letting my head fall back against his chest.
"I'll let you," I said. "The citizens of Le Havre will just have to take their chances with the pox."
It was nearly an hour before Jared came back, ears reddened with cold, but throat unslit, and apparently none the worse for wear. I was happy to see him.
"It's all right," he announced, beaming. "Nothing but scurvy and the usual fluxes and chills aboard. No pox."
He looked around the room, rubbing his hands together.
"Where's supper?"
His cheeks were wind-reddened, and he looked cheerful and capable. Apparently dealing with business rivals who settled contentions by assassination was all in a day's work to this merchant. And why not, I thought cynically. He was a bloody Scot, after all. As if to confirm this view, Jared ordered the meal, acquired an excellent wine to go with it by the simple expedient of sending to his own warehouse for it, and sat down to a genial post-prandial discussion with Jamie on ways and means of dealing with French merchants.
"Bandits," he said. "Every man jack of them would stab you in the back as soon as look at you. Filthy thieves. Don't trust them an inch. Half on deposit, half on delivery, and never let a nobleman pay on credit."
Despite Jared's assurances that he had left two men below on watch, I was still a bit nervous, and after supper I placed myself near the window where I could see the comings and goings along the pier. Not that my watching out was likely to do a lot of good, I thought. Every second man on the dock looked like an assassin to me. The clouds were closing in over the harbour. It was going to snow again tonight. The reefed sails fluttered wildly in the rising wind, rattling against the spars with a noise that nearly overwhelmed the shouts of the loaders. The harbour glowed with a moment of dull green light, as the setting sun was driven into the water by the pressing clouds. As it grew darker, the bustle to and fro died down, the loaders with their handcarts disappearing up the streets into the town, and the sailors disappearing into the lighted doors of establishments, like the one in which I sat. Still, the place was far from deserted. In particular, there was a small crowd still gathered near the ill-fated Patagonia. Men in some sort of uniform formed a cordon at the foot of the gangplank, no doubt to prevent anyone going aboard or bringing the cargo off. Jared had explained that the healthy members of the crew would be allowed to come ashore, but not permitted to bring anything off the ship save the clothes that they wore.
"Better than they do under the Dutch," he said, scratching the rough black stubble that was beginning to emerge along his jaw. "If a ship's coming in from a port known to have plague of some kind, the damned Hollanders make the sailors swim ashore naked."
"What do they do for clothes once they get ashore?" I asked curiously.
"I don't know," said Jared absently. "But since they'll find a brothel within moments of stepping on land, I don't suppose they'd need any. Begging your pardon, my dear," he added hastily, suddenly remembering that he was talking to a lady.
Covering his momentary confusion with heartiness, he rose and came to peer out of the window beside me.
"Ah," he said, "they're getting ready to fire the ship. Given what she's carrying, they'd best tow it a good way out into the harbour first."
Tow ropes had been attached to the doomed Patagonia, and a number of small boats manned by oarsmen were standing ready, waiting for a signal. This was given by the harbour master, whose gold braid was barely visible as a gleam in the dying light of the day. He shouted,
waving both hands slowly back and forth above his head like a semaphore. His shout was echoed by the captains of the rowboats and galleys, and the tow ropes slowly lifted from the water as they tautened, water sluicing down the heavy hemp spirals with a splash audible in the sudden silence that struck the docks. The shouts from the towboats were the only sound as the dark hulk of the condemned ship creaked, quivered, and turned into the wind, shrouds groaning as she set out on her last brief voyage. They left her in the middle of the harbour, a safe distance away from the other ships. Her decks had been soaked with oil, and as the tow ropes were cast off and the galleys pulled away, the small round figure of the harbour master rose from the seat of the dinghy that had rowed him out. He bent down, head close to one of the seated figures, then rose with the bright sudden flame of a torch in one hand. The rower behind him leaned away as he drew back his arm and threw the torch. A heavy club, wrapped with oil-soaked rags, it turned end over end, the fire shrinking to a blue glow, and landed out of sight behind the railing. The harbour master didn't wait to see the effects of his action. He sat down at once, gesturing madly to the rower, who heaved on the oars, and the small boat shot away across the dark water. For long moments, nothing happened, but the crowd on the dock stood still, murmuring quietly. I could see the pale reflection of Jamie's face floating above my own in the dark glass of the window. The glass was cold and misted over quickly with our breath. I rubbed it clear with the edge of my cloak. There, Jamie said softly. The flame ran suddenly behind the railing, a small blue glowing line. Then a flicker, and the forward shrouds sprang out, orange-red lines against the sky. A silent leap, and the tongues of fire danced along the oil-drenched rails, and one furled sail sparked and burst into flame. In less than a minute, the shrouds of the mizzen had caught, and the mainsail unfurled, its moorings burnt through, a falling sheet of flame. The fire spread too rapidly then to watch its progress. Everything seemed alight at once. Now, Jared said suddenly, come downstairs. The hold will catch in a minute, and that will be the best time to make away. No one will notice us. He was right. As we crept cautiously out of the tavern door, two men materialized beside Jared, his own seamen, armed with pistols and marlin spikes. But no one else noticed our appearance. Everyone was turned toward the harbour, where the superstructure of the Patagonia was visible now as a black skeleton inside a body of rippling flame. There was a series of pops, so close together they sounded like machine-gun fire, and then an almighty explosion that rose from the centre of the ship in a fountain of sparks and burning timbers. Let's go. Jamie's hand was firm on my arm, and I made no protest. Following Jared, guarded by the sailors, we stole away from the quay, surreptitious as though we had started the fire. Chapter 7 Royal Audience. Jared's house in Paris stood in the Rue Trémoulin. It was a wealthy district, with stone-faced houses of 3, 4, and 5 stories crowded cheek by jowl together. Here and there, a very large house stood alone in its own park, but for the most part, a reasonably athletic burglar could have leapt from rooftop to rooftop with no difficulty.
"Mm-hmm,"
was Myrtle's solitary observation upon beholding Jared's house.
"I'll find my own lodging." "And it makes you nervous to have a decent roof above your head, man. You can sleep in the stables," Jamie suggested.
He grinned down at his small, dour godfather.
"We'll hear the footman bring ye out your parritch on a silver tray."
Inside, the house was furnished with comfortable elegance, though, as I was later to realise, it was Spartan by comparison with most of the houses of the nobility and the wealthy bourgeois. I supposed that this was at least in part because the house had no lady. Jared had never married,
though he showed no signs of feeling the lack of a wife.
"Well, he has a mistress, of course,"
Jamie had explained when I speculated about his cousin's private life.
"Oh, of course," I murmured. "But she's married. Jared told me once a man of business should never form entanglements with unmarried ladies. He said they demand too much in terms of expense and time. And if you marry them, they'll run through your money and you'll end up a pauper."
"Fine opinion he's got of wives," I said. "What does he think of your marrying, in spite of all this helpful advice?" Jamie laughed.
"Well, I haven't got any money to start with, so I can hardly be worse off. He thinks you're very decorative. He says I must buy you a new gown, though."
I spread the skirt of the apple-green velvet, more than a little the worse for wear.
"I suppose so," I agreed.
"Or I'll go round wrapped in a bedsheet after a while. This is already tight in the waist."
"Elsewhere, too,"
he said, grinning, as he looked me over.
"Got your appetite back, have you, Sassenach?"
"Oaf," I said coldly. "You know perfectly well that Annabel Machranach is the general size and shape of a shovel handle, whereas I am not."
"You are not,"
he agreed, eyeing me with appreciation.
"Thank God."
He patted me familiarly on the bottom.
"I'm to join Jared at the warehouse this morning to go over the ledgers. Then we're going to call on some of his clients to introduce me. Will you be all right by yourself?"
"Yes, of course," I said. "I'll explore the house a bit and get acquainted with the servants." I had met the servants en masse when we had arrived late in the previous afternoon. But since we had dined simply in our room, I had seen no one since but the footman who brought the food and the maid who had come in early in the morning to put back the curtains, lay and light the fire, and carry away the chamber pot. I quailed a bit at the thought of suddenly being in charge of a staff, but reassured myself by thinking that it couldn't be much different from directing orderlies and junior nurses, and I'd done that before, as a senior nurse at a French field station in 1943. After Jamie's departure, I took my time in making what toilette could be made with a comb and water, which were the only grooming implements available. If Jared was serious about my holding dinner parties, I could see that a new gown was going to be merely the start of it. I did have, in the side pocket of my medicine chest, the frayed willow twigs with which I cleaned my teeth, and I got one of these and set to work, thinking over the amazing fortune which had brought us here. Essentially barred from Scotland, we would have had to find a place to make our future, either in Europe or by emigrating to America. And given what I now knew about Jamie's attitude towards ships, I wasn't at all surprised that he should have looked to France from the start. The Frasers had strong ties with France. Many of them, like Abbott Alexander and Jared Fraser, had made lives there, seldom, if ever, returning to their native Scotland. And there were many Jacobites as well, Jamie had told me, those who had followed their king into exile and now lived as best they could in France or Italy while awaiting his restoration.
"There's always talk of it," he had said. "In the houses, mostly, not the taverns. That's why nothing's come of it. When it gets to the taverns, you'll know it's serious."
"Tell me," I said, watching him brush the dust from his coat, "are all Scots born knowing about politics, or is it just you?" He laughed, but quickly sobered as he opened the huge armoire and hung up the coat. It looked worn and rather pathetic hanging by itself in the enormous cedar-scented space.
"Well, I'll tell you, Sassenach, I'd as soon not know. But born as I was between the Mackenzies and the Frasers, I'd little choice in the matter. And you don't spend a year in French society and 2 years in an army without learning how to listen to what's being said and what's being meant, and how to tell the difference between the two. Given these times, though, it isn't just me. There's neither laird nor cotter in the Highlands who can stand aside from what's to come."
What's to come? What was to come, I wondered. What would come, if we were not successful in our efforts here, was an armed rebellion, an attempt at restoration of the Stuart monarchy, led by the son of the exiled king, Prince Charles Edward Casimir Maria Sylvester Stuart. Bonnie Prince Charlie, I said softly to myself, looking over my reflection in the large pier glass. He was here, now, in the same city, perhaps not too far away. What would he be like? I could think of him only in terms of his usual historical portrait, which showed a handsome, slightly effeminate youth of 16 or so, with soft pink lips and powdered hair in the fashion of the times. Or the imagined paintings, showing a more robust version of the same thing, brandishing a broadsword as he stepped out of a boat onto the shore of Scotland. A Scotland he would ruin and lay waste in the effort to reclaim it for his father and himself. Doomed to failure, he would attract enough support to cleave the country and lead his followers through civil war to a bloody end on the field of Culloden. Then he would flee back to safety in France, but the retribution of his enemies would be exacted upon those he left behind. It was to prevent such a disaster that we had come. It seemed incredible, thinking about it in the peace and luxury of Jared's house. How did one stop a rebellion? Well, if risings were fomented in taverns, perhaps they could be stopped over dinner tables. I shrugged at myself in the mirror, blew an errant curl out of one eye, and went down to Cousin the cook. The staff, at first inclined to view me with frightened suspicion, soon realised that I had no intention of interfering with their work, and relaxed into a mood of wary obligingness. I had thought at first, in my blur of fatigue, that there were at least a dozen servants lined up in the hallway for my inspection. In fact, there were 16 of them, counting the groom, the stable lad, and the knife boy, whom I hadn't noticed in the general scrum. I was still more impressed at Jared's success in business, until I realised just how little the servants were paid. A new pair of shoes and 2 livres per year for the footman, a trifle less for the housemaids and kitchenmaids, a little more for such exalted personages as Madame Vionnet the cook and the butler, Magnus. While I explored the mechanics of the household and stored up what information I could glean at home from the gossip of the parlourmaids, Jamie was out with Jared every day, calling upon customers, meeting people, preparing himself to assist His Highness by making those social connections that might prove of value to an exiled prince. It was among the dinner guests that we might find allies or enemies. Saint-Germain, I said, suddenly catching a familiar name in the midst of Marguerite's chatter as she polished the parquet floor. The Comte Saint-Germain? Oui, madame. She was a small, fat girl, with an oddly flattened face, and pop eyes that made her look like a turbot, but she was friendly and eager to please. Now she pursed her mouth up into a tiny circle, portending the imparting of some really scandalous tidbit. I looked as encouraging as possible. "The Comte, madame, has a very bad reputation," she said portentously. Since this was true, according to Marguerite, of virtually everyone who came to dinner, I arched my brows and waited for further details. "He has sold his soul to the devil, you know," she confided, lowering her voice and glancing around as though that gentleman might be lurking behind the chimney breast. "He celebrates the Black Mass, at which the blood and flesh of innocent children are shared among the wicked." "A fine specimen you pick to make an enemy of," I thought to myself. "Oh, everyone knows, madame," Marguerite assured me. "But it does not matter. The women are mad for him anyway. Wherever he goes, they throw themselves at his head. But then he is rich." Plainly, this last qualification was at least sufficient to balance, if not to outweigh, the blood-drinking and flesh-eating. "How interesting," I said. "But I thought that Monsieur le Comte was a competitor of Monsieur Jared. Doesn't he also import wines? Why does Monsieur Jared invite him here, then?" Marguerite looked up from her floor polishing and laughed. "Why, madame, it is so Monsieur Jared can serve the best bone at dinner, tell Monsieur le Comte that he has just acquired 10 cases, and at the conclusion of the meal generously offer him a bottle to take home." "I see," I said, grinning. "And is Monsieur Jared similarly invited to dine with Monsieur le Comte?" She nodded, white kerchief bobbing over her oil bottle and rag. "Oh, yes, madame, but not as often." The Comte Saint-Germain was fortunately not invited for this evening. We dined simply en famille, so that Jared could rehearse Jamie in the few details left to be arranged before his departure. Of these, the most important was the King's levee at Versailles. Being invited to attend the King's levee was a considerable mark of favour, Jared explained over dinner.
"Not to you, lad," he said kindly, waving a fork at Jamie. "To me. The King wants to make sure I'm coming back from Germany. Or Duvernay, the Minister of Finance, does at least. The latest wave of taxes hit the merchants hard, and a good many of the foreigners left, with the ill effects on the Royal Treasury you can imagine."
He grimaced at the thought of taxes, scowling at the baby eel on his fork.
"I mean to be gone by Monday week. I'm waiting only for word that the Wilhelminas come in safe to Calais, then I'm off."
Jared took another bite of eel and nodded at Jamie, talking around the mouthful of food.
"I'm leaving the business in good hands, lad. I've no worry on that score. We might talk a bit before I go about other matters, though. I've arranged with the Earl Marischal that we'll go with him to Montmartre 2 days hence for you to pay your respects to His Highness Prince Charles Edward."
I felt a sudden thump of excitement in the pit of my stomach, and exchanged a quick glance with Jamie. He nodded at Jared, as though this were nothing startling, but his eyes sparkled with anticipation as he looked at me. So this was the start of it.
"His Highness lives a very retired life in Paris," Jared was saying, as he chased the last eels, slick with butter, around the edge of the plate. "It wouldn't be appropriate for him to appear in society until and unless the King receives him officially. So His Highness seldom leaves his house and sees few people, save those supporters of his father who come to pay their respects."
"That isn't what I've heard," I interjected.
"What?"
Two pairs of startled eyes turned in my direction, and Jared laid down his fork, abandoning the final eel to its fate. Jamie arched an eyebrow at me.
"What have you heard, Sassenach, and from whom?"
"From the servants," I said, concentrating on my own eels. Seeing Jared's frown, it occurred to me for the first time that it might not be considered quite the thing for the lady of the house to be gossiping with parlourmaids. "Well, the hell with it," I thought rebelliously. There wasn't much else for me to do. "The parlourmaid says that His Highness Prince Charles has been paying calls on the Princess Louise de la Tour de Rohan," I said, plucking a single eel off the fork and chewing slowly. They were delicious, but felt rather disconcerting if swallowed whole, as though the creature was still alive. I swallowed carefully. So far, so good. "In the absence of the lady's husband," I added delicately. Jamie looked amused, Jared horrified.
"The Princess de Rohan?"
Jared said.
"Marie-Louise Henriette Jean de la Tour d'Auvergne? Her husband's family are very close to the King."
He rubbed his fingers across his lips, leaving a buttery shine around his mouth.
"That could be very dangerous,"
he muttered, as though to himself.
"I wonder if the wee fool... But no. Surely he's more sense than that. It must be only inexperience. He's not been so much in society, and things are different in Rome. Still...
He left off muttering and turned to Jamie with decision.
That will be your first task, lad, in the service of His Majesty. You're much of an age with His Highness, but you have the experience and the judgment of your time in Paris, and my training, I flatter myself.
He smiled briefly at Jamie.
You can befriend His Highness, smooth his path as much as maybe, with those men that will be of use to him. You've met most of them by now. And explain to His Highness, as tactfully as you can, that gallantry in the wrong direction may do considerable damage to the aims of his father.
Jamie nodded absently, plainly thinking of something else.
How does our parlour maid come to know about His Highness's visit, Sassnach? He asked. She doesn't leave the house more than once a week to go to Mass, does she?
I shook my head and swallowed the next mouthful in order to reply. So far as I've worked it out, our kitchen maid heard it from the knife boy, who heard it from the stable lad, who got it from the groom next door. I don't know how many people there are in between, but the Rouen house is 3 doors down the street. I'd imagine the princess knows all about us too, I added cheerfully. At least she does, if she talks to her kitchen maid.
Ladies do not gossip with their kitchen maids, Jared said coldly.
He narrowed his eyes at Jamie in a silent adjuration to keep his wife in better order. I could see the corner of Jamie's mouth twitching, but he merely sipped his Montrachet and changed the subject to a discussion of Jared's latest venture, a shipment of rum on its way from Jamaica. When Jared rang the bell for the dishes to be cleared and the brandy brought out, I excused myself. One of Jared's idiosyncrasies was the enjoyment of long black cheroots with his brandy, and I had the distinct feeling that, carefully chewed or not, the eels I had eaten wouldn't benefit from being smoked. I lay on my bed and tried, with limited success, not to think about eels. I closed my eyes and tried to think of Jamaica, pleasant white beaches under tropical sun. But thoughts of Jamaica led to thoughts of the Wilhelmina, and thoughts of ships made me think of the sea, which led directly back to images of giant eels coiling and writhing through the heaving green waves. I greeted the distraction of Jamie's appearance with relief, sitting up as he came in.
Phew!
He leaned against the closed door, fanning himself with the loose end of his jabot.
I feel like a smoked sausage. I'm fond of Jared, but I shall be very pleased when he's taken his damn cheroots to Germany.
Well, don't come near me if you smell like a cheroot, I said. The eels don't like smoke.
I didn't blame them a bit.
He took off his coat and unbuttoned his shirt.
I think it's a plan, you can,
he confided, tossing his head toward the door as he took his shirt off.
Like the bees.
Bees?
How you move a hive of bees, he explained,
opening the window and hanging his shirt outside from the crank of the casement.
You get a pipe full of the strongest tobacco you can find, stick it into the hive, and blow smoke up into the combs. The bees all fall down stunned, and you can take them where you like. I think that's what Jared does to his customers. He smokes them into insensibility, and they've signed orders for 3 times more wine than they meant to before they recover their senses.
I giggled, and he grinned, putting a finger to his lips, as the sound of Jared's light footsteps came down the corridor, passing our door on his way to his own room. Danger of discovery passed. He came and stretched out beside me, wearing only his kilt and stockings.
"Not too bad," he asked. "I can sleep in the dressing room if it is, or put my head out of the window for airing."
I sniffed his hair where the scent of tobacco lingered among the ruddy waves. The candlelight shot the red with strands of gold, and I ruffled my fingers through it, enjoying the thick softness of it and the hard, solid feel of the bone beneath.
No, it's not too bad.
You're not worried about Jared leaving so soon, then? He kissed my forehead and lay down, head on the bolster. He smiled up at me, shaking his head.
No. I've met all the chief customers and the captains. I know all the warehousemen and the officials. I've the price lists and inventories committed to memory. What's left to learn about the business, I must just learn by trying. Jared canna teach me more.
And Prince Charles? He half closed his eyes and gave a small grunt of resignation.
Ah, well, for that I must trust to the mercy of God, not Jared. And I dare say it will be easier if Jared isn't here to see what I'm doing.
I lay down beside him, and he turned toward me, sliding an arm around my waist so that we lay close together.
"What shall we do?" I asked. "Have you any idea, Jamie?"
His breath was warm on my face, scented with brandy, and I tilted my head up to kiss him. His soft, wide mouth opened on mine, and he lingered in the kiss for a moment before answering.
"Oh, I've ideas," he said, drawing back with a sigh. "God knows what they'll amount to, but I've ideas."
"Tell me."
"Mm-hmm."
He settled himself more comfortably, turning on his back and cradling me in one arm, head on his shoulder.
"Well," he began, "as I see it, it's a matter of money, Sassnach."
"Money? I should have thought it was a matter of politics. Don't the French want James restored because it will cause the English trouble? From the little I recall, Louis wanted...
will want, I corrected myself,
Charles Stuart to distract King George from what Louis is up to in Brussels."
"I dare say he does," he said. "But restoring kings takes money. And Louis hasn't got so much himself that he can be using it on the one hand to fight wars in Brussels, and on the other to finance invasions of England. You heard what Jared said about the royal treasury and the taxes?"
"Yes, but..."
"No, it isn't a Louis that will make it happen," he said, instructing me. "Though he's something to say about it, of course. No, there are other sources of money that James and Charles will be trying as well. And those are the French banking families, the Vatican, and the Spanish court."
"James covering the Vatican and the Spanish, and Charles the French bankers, you think?" I asked, interested.
He nodded, staring up at the carved panels of the ceiling. The walnut panels were a soft light brown in the flickering candle glow, darker rosettes and ribbons twining from each corner.
"Aye, I do. Uncle Alec showed me correspondence from His Majesty King James, and I should say the Spanish are his best opportunity, judging from that. The Pope's compelled to support him, you ken, as a Catholic monarch. Pope Clement supported James for a good many years, and now Clement's dead, Benedict continues it, but not at such a high level. But both Philip of Spain and Louis are James's cousins. It's the obligation of the Bourbon blood he calls on there."
He smiled wryly at me, sidelong.
"And from the things I've seen, I can tell you that royal blood runs damn thin when it comes to money, Sassnach."
Lifting one foot at a time, he stripped off his stockings one-handed and tossed them onto the bedroom stool.
"James got some money from Spain 30 years ago," he observed. "A small fleet of ships and some men as well. That was the rising in 1715. But he had ill luck, and James's forces were defeated at Sheriffsmuir before James himself even arrived. So I'd say the Spanish are maybe none too eager to finance a second try at the Stuart restoration, not without a very good idea that it might succeed."
"So... Charles has come to France to work on Louis and the bankers," I mused. "And according to what I know of history, he'll succeed. Which leaves us where?" Jamie's arm left my shoulders as he stretched, the shift of his weight tilting the mattress under me.
"It leaves me selling wine to bankers, Sassenach," he said, yawning, "and you talking to parlourmaids. And if we blow enough smoke, perhaps we'll stun the bees."
Just before Jared's departure, he took Jamie to a small house in Montmartre, where His Highness Prince Charles Edward Louis Philip Casimir, etc. Stuart, was residing, biding his time, while waiting to see what Louis would or would not do for an impecunious cousin with aspirations to a throne. I had seen them off, both dressed in their best, and spent the time while they were gone, picturing the encounter in my mind, wondering how it had gone. "How did it go?" I asked Jamie the moment I got him alone upon his return. "What was he like?" He scratched his head, thinking. "Well," he said at last,
"he had a toothache."
"What?"
"He said so, and it looked very painful. He kept his face screwed up to one side with his jaw puffed a bit. I cannot say whether he's stiff in his manner usually, or if it was only that it hurt him to talk, but he didn't say much."
After the formal introductions, in fact the older men, Jared and the Earl Marischal, and a rather seedy-looking specimen referred to casually as Bolhaldy, had gravitated together and begun talking Scottish politics, leaving Jamie and His Highness more or less to themselves.
"We had a cup of brandy wine each," Jamie obediently reported under my goading. "And I asked him how he found Paris, and he said he was finding it rather tiresomely confining, as he couldn't get any hunting. And so then we talked of hunting. He prefers hunting with dogs to hunting with beaters, and I said I did too. Then he told me how many pheasants he'd shot on one hunting trip in Italy. He talked about Italy until he said the cold air coming in through the window was hurting his tooth. It's no a very well-built house, just a small villa. Then he drank some more brandy wine for his tooth, and I told him about stag hunting in the Highlands, and he said he'd like to try that sometime, and was I a good shot with a bow? And I said I was. And he said he hoped he would have the opportunity to invite me to hunt with him in Scotland. And then Jared said he needed to stop at the warehouse on the way back, so His Highness gave me his hand and I kissed it, and we left."
"Hmm," I said. While reason asserted that naturally the famous, or about to be famous, or possibly famous, at any rate, were bound to be much like everyone else in their daily behaviour, I had to admit that I found this report of the Bonny Prince a bit of a letdown. Still, Jamie had been invited back. The important thing, as he pointed out, was to become acquainted with His Highness in order to keep an eye on his plans as any developed. I wondered whether the King of France would be a trifle more impressive in person. We were not long in finding out. A week later, Jamie rose in the cold black dark and dressed himself for the long ride to Versailles to attend the King's levee. Louis awoke punctually at 6 o'clock every morning. At this hour, the favoured few chosen to attend the King's toilette should be assembled in the antechamber, ready to join the procession of nobles and attendants who were necessary to assist the monarch in greeting the new day. Wakened in the small hours by Magnus the butler, Jamie stumbled sleepily out of bed and made ready, yawning and muttering. At this hour my insides were tranquil, and I luxuriated in that delightful feeling that comes when we observe someone having to do something unpleasant that we are not required to do ourselves.
"Watch carefully," I said, my voice husky with sleep, "so you can tell me everything."
With a sleepy grunt of assent, he leaned over to kiss me, then shuffled off, candle in hand, to see to the saddling of his horse. The last I heard before sinking back under the surface of sleep was Jamie's voice downstairs, suddenly clear and alert in the crisp night air, exchanging farewells with the groom in the street outside. Given the distance to Versailles, and the chance, of which Jared had warned, of being invited to lunch, I wasn't surprised when he didn't return before noon. But I couldn't help being curious, and waited in increasing impatience until his arrival, finally, near tea time. "And how was the King's levee?" I asked, coming to help Jamie remove his coat. Wearing the tight pigskin gloves de rigueur at court, he couldn't manage the crested silver buttons on the slippery velvet.
"Ooh, that feels better,"
he said, flexing his broad shoulders in relief as the buttons sprang free. The coat was much too tight in the shoulders. Peeling him out of it was like shelling an egg.
"Interesting, Sassnach," he said, in answer to my question, "at least for the first hour or so."
As the procession of nobles came into the royal bedchamber, each bearing his ceremonial implement, towel, razor, ale cup, royal seal, etc., the gentlemen of the bedchamber drew back the heavy curtains that kept out the dawn, unveiled the draperies of the great bed of state, and exposed the face of Le Roi Louis to the interested eye of the rising sun. Assisted to a sitting position on the edge of his bed, the king had sat, yawning and scratching his stubbled chin, while his attendants pulled a silk robe, heavy with embroidery of silver and gold, over the royal shoulders, and knelt to strip off the heavy felt stockings in which the king slept, to be replaced with hose of lighter silk and soft slippers lined with rabbit fur. One by one, the nobles of the court came to kneel at the feet of their sovereign to greet him respectfully and ask how His Majesty had passed the night.
"Not very well, I should say," Jamie broke off to observe here. "He looked like he'd slept little more than an hour or two, and bad dreams with it."
Despite bloodshot eyes and drooping jowls, His Majesty had nodded graciously to his courtiers, then risen slowly to his feet and bowed to those favoured guests hovering in the back of the chamber. A dispirited wave of the hand summoned a gentleman of the bedchamber, who led His Majesty to the waiting chair, where he sat with closed eyes, enjoying the ministrations of his attendants, while the visitors were led forward, one at a time, by the Duke d'Orléans, to kneel before the king and offer a few words of greeting. Formal petitions would be offered a little later, when there was a chance of Louis being awake enough to hear them.
"I wasn't there for petitioning, but only as a mark of favour," Jamie explained. "So I just knelt and said, 'Good morning, Your Majesty,' while the Duke told the King who I was."
"Did the King say anything to you?" I asked. Jamie grinned, hands linked behind his head as he stretched.
"Oh, aye. He opened one eye and looked at me as though he didn't believe it."
One eye still open, Louis had surveyed his visitor with a sort of dim interest, then remarked,
"Big, aren't you?"
I said,
"Yes, Your Majesty," Jamie said. Then he said, "Can you dance?" And I said I could. Then he shut his eye again, and the Duke motioned me back.
Introductions complete, the gentlemen of the bedchamber, ceremoniously assisted by the chief nobles, had then proceeded to make the king's toilette. As they did so, the various petitioners came forward at the beckoning of the Duke d'Orléans to murmur into the king's ear as he twisted his head to accommodate the razor, or bent his neck to have his wig adjusted. "Oh, and were you honoured by being allowed to blow His Majesty's nose for him?" I asked. Jamie grinned, stretching his linked hands until the knuckles cracked.
"No, thank God." I skulked about against the wardrobe, trying to look like part of the furniture, with the bitty wee comtes and dukes all glancing at me out of the sides of their eyes, as though Scottishness were catching.
"Well, at least you were tall enough to see everything."
"Oh, aye, that I did. Even when he eased himself on his chaise percée."
"He really did that? In front of everyone?" I was fascinated. I'd read about it, of course, but found it difficult to believe.
"Why? And everyone behaving just as they did when he washed his face and blew his nose?" The Duc de Nave had the unspeakable honour, he added ironically, of wiping His Majesty's ass for him. I didn't notice what they did with the towel. Took it out and had it gilded, no doubt. A very wearisome business it was, too, he added, bending over and setting his hands on the floor to stretch the muscles of his legs. Took forever. The man's tight as an owl.
Tight as an owl? I asked, amused at the simile. Constipated, do you mean?
Aye, costive. And no wonder, the things they eat at court, he added censoriously, stretching backward. Terrible diet, all cream and butter. He should eat porridge every morning for breakfast. That'd take care of it. Very good for the bowels, you ken.
If Scotsmen were stubborn about anything, and in fact they tended to be stubborn about quite a number of things, truth be known, it was the virtues of oatmeal porridge for breakfast. Through eons of living in a land so poor there was little to eat but oats, they had, as usual, converted necessity into a virtue, and insisted that they liked the stuff. Jamie had by now thrown himself on the floor, and was doing the Royal Air Force exercises I had recommended to strengthen the muscles of his back. Returning to his earlier remark, I said, "Why did you say tight as an owl? I've heard that before, to mean drunk, but not costive. Are owls constipated, then?" Completing his course, he flipped over and lay on the rug, panting.
"Why?"
He blew out a long sigh and caught his breath. He sat up and pushed the hair out of his eyes.
"Or not really, but that's the story you hear. Folk will tell you that owls haven't got an arsehole, so they canna pass the things they eat, like mice, eh? So the bones and the hairs and such are all made up into a ball, and the owl vomits them out, not being able to get rid of them out the other end."
"Really?
Oh, aye, that's true enough, they do. That's how you find an owl tree. Look underneath for the pellets on the ground. Make a terrible mess, owls do," he added, pulling his collar away from his neck to let air in. "But they have got arseholes," he informed me. "I knocked one out of a tree once with a slingshot loot."
"A lad with an inquiring mind, eh?" I said, laughing.
"To be sure, Sassnach," he grinned. "And they do pass things that way, too. I spent a whole day sitting under an owl tree with Ian once, just to make sure."
"Christ, you must have been curious," I remarked.
"Well, I wanted to know. Ian didn't want to sit still so long, and I had to pound on him a bit to make him stop fidgeting."
Jamie laughed, remembering.
"So he sat still with me till it happened, and then he snatched up a handful of owl pellets, jammed them down the neck of my shirt, and was off like a shot. God, he could run like the wind."
A tinge of sadness crossed his face, his memory of the fleet-footed friend of his youth clashing with more recent memories of his brother-in-law hobbling stiffly, if good-naturedly, on the wooden leg a round of grape shot taken in a foreign battle had left him with. "That sounds an awful way to live," I remarked, wanting to distract him. "Not watching owls, I don't mean. The king. No privacy, ever. Not even in the loo."
"I wouldn't care for it myself," Jamie agreed. "But then, he's the king."
And I suppose all the power and luxury and so forth makes up for a lot." He shrugged.
"Well, if it does or no, it's the bargain God's made for him, and he's little choice but to make the best of it."
He picked up his plaid and drew the tail of it through his belt and up to his shoulder.
"Here, let me."
I took the silver ring brooch from him and fastened the flaming fabric at the crest of his shoulder. He arranged the drape, smoothing the vivid wool between his fingers.
"Have a bargain like that myself, Sassnach," he said quietly, looking down at me.
He smiled briefly.
"Though thank God it doesn't mean inviting Ian to wipe my arse for me. But I was born laird. I'm the steward of that land, and the people on it, and I must make the best of my own bargain with them.
He reached out and touched my hair lightly.
"That's why I was glad when you said we'd come to try to see what we might do."